Welcome to Talking Walking, hosted by Andrew Stuck from Rethinking Cities in London. Talking Walking brings you interviews with people from the world of walking, artists, activists, professionals, and those of us who have a passion for just taking a walk. To meet Jess Allen, I began by walking for a few minutes to my local station, travelling by train for just shy of 4 hours, and then walking for a further 3.5 hours. Jess stepped out of her front door and walked for 7 hours. We were meant to meet on the Office Dyke path, but a miscalculation meant that our rendezvous was actually on the Gloucestershire Way at Bower Spring on a hot and thundery afternoon in early August 2013. Both she and I experienced a change in tension when we realised that we were on parallel paths and that instead of encountering each other face to face, we had to arrange to meet at a certain point. Such nuances are the bread and butter of her walking art practice, and you can't help be drawn by Jess's infectious enthusiasm for walking. What we've done is we've stepped off the path. So perhaps, Jess, you'd like to tell me first of all where you've walked today.
I have walked from Lee in South Herefordshire near Rothamway, right across the Forest of Dean to a place called Buff Springs. But I've walked along the Gloucestershire Way and then I've met up with the Office Dyke Path. And I'm en route to the Green Gathering at Chepstow Racecourse.
And tell us a little bit about the route that you've taken. What you encountered on the way? Did you meet people? Did you find your way blocked? What's the score?
I'm actually covered in some quite serious scratches. It's been quite a battle with undergrowth and overgrowth, which I suppose is a symptom of the time of year, including head-high maize first thing this morning, which I was unable to penetrate, so I had to come another way. I've been chased by bullocks. I've seen lots of butterflies and signs of wild boar. Not an awful lot of people. A few recreational walkers in the Forest of Dean.
And what's the total distance you'll have walked by the end of the day to get to the Green Gathering?
I've been trying to work it out, but it's going to be between 20 and 30 miles, I think.
And we can hear the drumming in the background. We should put that in now. So we're pretty close to the Green Gathering as we speak.
As the crow flies over the way.
How long has it taken you? When did you start off this morning?
I set off just before 8. So it took me about 7 hours to get to where we rendezvoused. I've worked out, this is very interesting to me, that when I put my hand, the full span of my hand on a 1 to 25,000 OS map, that is the distance I can walk in an hour. More or less allowing for a bit of whimsical photography and the occasional chat with someone if it was not too long, or getting a bit lost, but not all those things at once. So if I do get a bit lost, I find myself not conversing with people or not stopping. I tend not to walk with a time destination in mind, so our rendezvous today was a little bit unusual in terms of my practice, because I realised that I'm a bit like my dog. I tend to be quite interested in sights and smells and sounds, and so I get rather distracted from the route if I'm actually going to meet someone. It becomes a bit there's a bit more of a tension, I suppose.
What you've done in the last 7 hours is probably more than anyone else would normally do, and it sort of leads well on to what you're doing at the moment, which is called All in a Day's Walk. So would you like to explain a little bit about All in a Day's Walk?
All in a Day's Walk is a month-long performance piece that I first did back in December 2012 to January 2013. It's the first performance piece that I've devised for my PhD research, the title of which is Tractivism, Walking and Moving in Rural Landscapes as an Activist Arts Practice, or perhaps I should call it Walking and Moving and Talking in Rural Landscapes as an Activist Arts Practice, because that's quite key to what I do. My practice generally is about exploring how walking in rural landscapes can be a means of facilitating encounter with other people. And the themes that I choose to shape my walks aesthetically on the ground or the general intention of what I'm doing are ways into conversation with those people, and that I hope will elicit some kind of response in them. And if it doesn't, that's fine, but I'm interested in their perspectives, and I'm interested in sowing little seeds So it's a very gentle form of activism, really. I have a series of rules that I follow. So it is in some ways a life performance practice. The score is that for a month I live entirely within the distance that I can walk away from home in a day, mostly going back home, but not necessarily, and only eating the food that's grown, processed and obtainable within that distance. The rules of the score are that I can only walk, I can't accept any lifts, I can't use public transport, I can't cycle. I have ridden my horse a couple of times, I have run a couple of times, but it's always been on foot. As I say, I can only use produce that's been grown, processed and obtainable within the distance that I can walk. I'm allowed to buy it from, for example, a village shop, but if I do so, then I have to walk out to where it's come from. And even if I don't speak to the producers, which I generally aim to do, it's the point that I've made the journey. So in a way, at the start, there isn't a score for the walks. There isn't a map of the walks I will do. I just start sustaining myself, and in doing so, it then gives me the destinations that I have to go to. So in a way, the performance builds itself as it goes along. The other rules are that I can't accept hospitality or gifts or food from guests that doesn't meet those criteria, because obviously otherwise that would be quite easy. The reason I'm repeating it in summer is that in the intervening time since the December performance, I've talked to a lot of people during the performance, I've talked to a lot of people after the performance, I've been invited to give talks about what I do because people really bought into it and got really engaged with it. One of the questions people kept saying to me was, how would you find this different at different times of year? Someone even suggested, because the project is scored on the number 6, because it went from the 6th of December to the 6th of January and it had 6 general rules and I had 6 epiphanies at the end, he said, wouldn't it be interesting if you did it for 6 years running in the same play? But because it was a December performance, I thought, that means I'll be living in the caravan for Christmas for 6 years. So I decided to repeat it in the summer with the experiences that I had from the first performance, one of which is that I now eat meat, pasture-fed, local, free-range meat.
What did you crave the most by the end of it?
Porridge. Desperately crave porridge. Ah, right. All in a Day's Walk was designed to draw attention to loss. I was curious about how possible it would be, or should be, in a very fertile agricultural county like Herefordshire, a very versatile county, not like the Mid Wales uplands where I grew up, which is when farmer I met just before the project started said, well, if you did it here, you'd bloody starve. So I'm allowed to do a Welsh accent because I'm actually Welsh, so it's fine. But what I was trying to draw attention to was the loss of rural infrastructure that made it really hard for me to sustain myself at the time as a almost lifelong vegetarian and someone who's allergic to dairy and as someone who isn't meant to eat a lot of potatoes because I have a joint problem. So what did I crave the most? I craved oats the most because in Herefordshire, all the oats of the entire county are shipped outside to be processed. One of the other rules was that I would walk or try to walk for 6 days a week. So to demonstrate that it wasn't just that I was toddling off to the farm shop 2 miles away and back, that it was a sort of committed walking practice as well.
If we just go back to the PhD, from what you were talking about, you called it tractivism. It sounds like you've got a PhD in trespassing.
It does a bit, doesn't it? And that's actually quite contradictory. I'm actually a very polite activist. I don't like upsetting people, and I'm very conscious when I'm out in the rural landscape of being on the right path. I think I'm just very well behaved. With tractivism, I'm referring to something a lot more subtle than direct activism. And I've inevitably done a lot of reading about different types of activisms, and there are so many now, trying to define for myself what activism is. And I've discovered that the activism we tend to associate most commonly with the word is placard waving, marching, shouting, slogan drawing, or quite impressive direct action, on which I think is great and totally has its place in the activist arsenal. But there are new forms that are coming to the fore that might ultimately result in more sustainable change in people's lives or behavioural patterns. Those are things like relational activism, which I've read is tends to be a female practice, and it's about living in the way that you feel it is right to live in the context of environmentalism, living ecologically in an ecologically aware way, and in doing so and in being convivial and inviting other people into your social circle, into your life, in doing so demonstrating that it's a good way of doing things and an attractive way of doing things. So it's much more subtle and much less in your face, I suppose, and also something that the philosopher and performance writer Wallace Heim calls slow activism, in the context of a piece by the London activist group Platform, which used conversation at the core, and this idea that you, through having interactions with people on a one-to-one level and listening to them and being receptive to them at the same time as offering your own perspectives, can give rise to change in more subtle ways. This all came about as a result of my a project I did in 2010 called Tilting at Windmills.
You just mentioned Tilting at Windmills, and I was going to ask you about that. So, yeah, tell us a little bit about it, and tell us also about how it emerged as a project.
Yes.
And has now been made into a film.
Yes.
And then maybe tell us how it might have evolved further.
So Tilting was a piece that I did for my MA in dance making and performance at Coventry University. It was my final project, and it came about through a slightly embarrassing set of circumstances, in that I had gone to Coventry with quite conventional ideas about contemporary dance and performance practice generally, and had those just seriously challenged in my time there, so that by the time it came to my final project, I thought, okay, I'm going to do something really radical and really that's not dancing in a studio. I had always been interested in walking practice. I had made my final piece, undergraduate dance piece, about maps and mapping, drawing on the work of Richard Long and Simon Whitehead. So I was already heading in that direction, I think. But I was also seeking to reconcile these very disparate elements of my life at the time, which was being a dance postgraduate student and part-time dancer and teaching dance, and also being a landscape officer for a local authority. So I wanted to bring those together. I thought, I'm very interested in wind turbines as aesthetic or not elements in the landscape, and as a symbol of something more profound, because I'm an environmentalist, I come from Mid Wales, and they've never offended me. Those are my landscapes, and there are a lot of wind farms in those landscapes. But I was interested in what other people had to say about it. But at the same time, I was generally interested in what other people had to say about responses to climate change, because that's very much really what, to me, they say when I see them. So I conceived a 7 or 8 day walk around the wind farms of Mid Wales, and the project just took on a life of its own, really. I conceived it and planned it and did it and wrote about it and made a film about it and made an artist book within about 6 or 7 weeks and an installation. So it really just had a life of its own. So I borrowed a sound recorder, which I'd never used before, and thought it would be interesting to simply record the conversations that I had with people that I bumped into. You would think that there would not be that many people you would bump into walking in rural Mid Wales, but for some reason, something about the intention of what I was doing must have been quite legible in my body, and I wrote about this in a subsequent paper, because people kept stopping me and saying, oh, hello, and what are you doing? And I found my way into conversation in so many ways with people. I had such great conversations with them, and they were so political. And I shouldn't be surprised. I mean, why would I be surprised, really? But we tend to sort of associate the political with cities, with academics, with intellectuals, with thinkers. Not to say that these people, some of these people were not those things, but, you know, in rural Mid Wales, these were farmers, these were smallholders, gardeners, shopkeepers, and they all had something really profound and really political to say. And I got really addicted to this idea of sound recording conversation, which you might relate to. there's something about people's words that are like ripe apples on a tree, and sometimes you switch the recorder off and they keep talking and they say amazing things and you think, oh, I didn't capture it, you know, it's one I've dropped on the floor. When I came back from the walk, I had not really thought about what I was going to do with these sound recordings. I knew I was going to have some kind of installation, I didn't know if it was going to be a performance, and I had very little time to do it. But my best friend Sarah Pennon-Jones is an environmentalist filmmaker, also based in Aberystwyth, and we just talked about the possibility of making this film where we would use these disembodied voices from the audio and use them as a score for a film in which I was basically just walking around a wind farm that's not far from Aber, one of the ones I had visited. We then chose how we would juxtapose images and sound to be gently political, perhaps, but also to give space for people to contemplate what was being said. And it was a very interesting process for her because she's a documentary filmmaker, observational documentary filmmaker, who's used to having the subject in front of the camera. So the idea that she had these disembodied voices was quite an unusual one for her. And also making an installation film where there were very long shots and it was quite slow and quite hypnotic, really, particularly with the wind, with the turbines. She said she'd wake up. She'd wake up, go to bed and wake up with wind turbines going around her head when we were editing it. So that's how the project evolved. When I came to reflect on it, I thought, actually what I've done, or what I'm doing, is an activism by stealth, because here I am innocently walking around the countryside, and it was genuinely innocently, but with my own political ideas or environmentalist ideas, I'm encouraging people to talk about this. And they want to, and I'm wondering whether I've left something with them that they will think about. Whether or not that brings about tangible change doesn't really seem to matter, but the fact that it might further on. So when I then came to think that I'd really like to develop this as a walking practice, and something I'd quite like to research and reflect on, basically that activism by stealth idea then informed me writing a PhD proposal to develop my walking practice as something that interfaced with my kind of political practice in a way. I mean, I'm not a party political person by any stretch of the imagination, but I realised as I've got older that I am political in my lifestyle choices and my environmentalist beliefs, which is somebody said to me a few years ago, your environmentalism is like a religion. And actually that's a very profound thing to say, because it is. You have a series of beliefs that you adhere to. So having had these disparate elements in my life, I just wanted to bring it into one thing, and walking seemed to be at the core of that, and talking seemed to be at the core of that. So tractivism was born quite frivolously, because I had come across the term slacktivism, which is the kind of internet petition, Facebook clicking, click on this website, it will help people, there you are, it's all done now kind of attitude. The idea that if you do something of minimal effort to you on the internet, online, in front of a computer, it will have some effect. And then that assuages your conscience, or it makes you feel like you've done something. I think, I'm not suggesting that internet petitions are not good and are not useful, I'm sure they can be, but I think it's that the fact that it makes people feel that, okay, I've done that now. A bit like recycling. If you do your recycling, it's great, but it should be the very least thing that you do, really, in my environmentalist belief system. So I come across the term slacktivism, and I thought that actually what I was doing, which was quite embodied and about real conversations with people who were speaking in Tilting from a more embodied place for being outdoors, being in their environment, being in the landscape that we were talking about, and in the midst of the politics perhaps that we were discussing. So I thought that was the antithesis really of this idea of just being in front of the computer and being detached from things. Tractivism simply came about as a frivolous play on words, really. If you can have slacktivism, then you can have tractivism, because in the countryside, generally, you walk along tracks.
What I often ask the interviewees, I ask them if they'd like to suggest a couple of walks. I'll recommend a couple of walks. Now, I don't know whether they're going to be seven-hour treks in search of food, but can you think of a couple of walks?
I can think of lots of walks that may or may not be connected to my practice. My absolute favourite walk of all time is the walk up the Doethia Valley near Llynbriannu in mid-South Wales, north of Llandovery, and going up to Soar y Mynydd, the chapel, the mountain chapel, and then looping back again. It's been a little bit, I would say gentrified, mountain bikeified, since I first did it with a horse many, many years ago, when it was quite treacherous, with big drops down one side down into the valley. But that's my absolute favourite walk of all time. And then I think there are some beautiful walks in Herefordshire, which I had never allowed myself to believe because it's a lowland landscape. So I would recommend the walk. Oh, there's so many. I think anything that loops onto the Wye Valley Walk in South Herefordshire is beautiful. But Yetton Woods between Howe Capel, this is deep Herefordshire, and Muchmarkle is really beautiful. And to get to it, you have to go through a farm called Chapel Farm, which has, extraordinarily, a chapel, private chapel, apparently, in the farmyard. And the woods are so eerie and strange. I've walked through them in deep snow, and they always remind me of the Robert Frost poem. And I hadn't realised that Robert Frost was, of course, a Dymock poet, and that actually it's only a stone's throw, well, only half a day's walk from Dymock. So I wondered, part of me wondered, was that one of his haunts? So yeah, I could recommend loads more. Also, go walk up to a wind turbine. They're really exciting. The best wind turbine walk that I did, there's a really beautiful walk that goes from the Ystwyth Wind Farm, which is the one that on the A44, as you go through Pont Heriwyd, past Ystym Tien. And you can walk through the wood there and over to Bont Goch, and you drop down into the village and then up onto Mynydd Gorddi, which is another wind farm, which is where we made Tilting. And there are views out up, back up north to, well, to North Wales, back into Mid Wales and Llanlimmon, and then out to the Ynyslas dunes and the estuary. It's beautiful.
You're actually coming to the Green Gathering because you're going to talk about All in a Day's Walk.
Yes.
At the Green Gathering.
That is the intention. It's been a little bit, it's going to be a little bit of a haphazard, get my map out and just do it kind of talk, I think. I invented a foodstuff called, a cake called Mumpets in the first version of All in a Day's Walk, which was a fatless, necessarily, because I wasn't eating dairy at the time and I couldn't get any oil, sugarless, because obviously she couldn't get any sugar, but it has honey in it, a fatless, sugarless stovetop beetroot cake that was composed of beetroot, eggs, a little bit of flour, which I got from a local mill, which is quite an unusual thing, and honey and apple juice, that was then all mixed together and put on the top of the stove in an improvised Dutch oven, which was Mina Croze cook pot. And it comes out as the same colour as my hair, as everyone's always happy to point out. And the consistency, somewhere between, as my partner described it, a muffin and a crumpet. They were named Mumpets. So every talk that I've done about the project, I have made Mumpets and taken them and handed them out. And I've had varying comments, some rather more polite than others, but the best one was that at an activist performance event in Manchester, they thought I was handing out raw liver. But I'm far too polite and non-subversive an activist for that. So I haven't brought Mumpets with me. I have made some flapjacks for the cafe where I'll also be helping out, which are Three Counties flapjacks, comprised entirely of Shropshire porridge oats, Gloucestershire butter from Wollaston, which I've just walked past, and Herefordshire honey from Gorsley.
When you leave the Green Gathering on Monday, you're going to walk, you're going to walk home. And you told me that there's a choice, really, because you could walk on the western side of the Wye,
yes,
up the Wye, is it called the Wye Valley Walk?
It is.
Or you could come back the way you've come. And what's your choice going to be?
My choice is going to be going back the way I've come, because I've had such a scrambly struggle on the way down, and I've so often missed the path in some places and had to improvise and wound up hedge scratched the other side of it. So there's a certain kind of psychogeographic satisfaction in the idea of going back up the path from another direction and hitting all the markers that I missed the last time.
You're going to be walking uphill because you're
going to know the route better, do you think you'll cover the time, the distance in a quicker time?
Definitely. Much as I was describing myself as like my dog and a bit of a distracted walker, that's only really in the context of documenting my practice. When I'm actually walking for pleasure, I suppose, when it hasn't got a sort of a fairly performative element, I'm a very fast walker. Annoyingly so, that other people won't walk with me. I get very frustrated by mislaying the route because it irks and offends my fast walker's pride.
fast walker's pride. Fast, I mean, pride. I thought you were going to say rhythm.
But oh, well, no.
It's pride. It's pride, isn't it?
There's an element of that, maybe. We have a lot of academic discussions about walking practitioners. There's a lot of writing, excellent writing by Dee Hedden and Kathy Turner about the absence of female walking practitioners from a lot of the critical writing, certainly. And the idea that a female walking practice is less overtly kind of competitive or less about extremes and less about endurance. If I compare myself to that definition of female walking practice, then I'm definitely a male walking practitioner. I take great satisfaction from walking ridiculously far distances and getting sunburnt, scratched and dehydrated in the process. And I don't... My supervisor was suggesting that maybe this was slightly self-regarding, but it's not really about what other people think of me doing that. It's just about hitting my own edges. I find it very satisfying. I've even contemplated being a running artist. Greg Whelan's got that covered.
You've been listening to Talking Walking, brought to you by Rethinking Cities in London. In this episode, you've heard from Jess Allen. If you have any views on this interview or any walking issues, we would love to hear from you. Just follow the links on the Talking Walking website. We look forward to having you along for future episodes of Talking Walking. Written, recorded and produced by Andrew Stuck of Rethinking Cities Limited. Our artwork is designed by Ian Martin of Aardvark Graphics and the music is composed by Simon Saunders of EZtronic.